Next up, we have Matt from Milliman, speaking on pricing flood and severe thunderstorm. Matt is a consulting actuary in the San Francisco office of Milliman, one of the world's largest independent actuarial consulting firms. Matt's expertise is in the pricing of cat risk for primary insurance companies. He has developed highly granular pricing algorithms for hurricane and severe thunderstorm perils. Most recently, he has been developing pricing approaches for private flood insurance. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you. So it's great to be here in South Africa to be able to talk about flood and hail and recent developments in the United States in terms of pricing these perils and some of the potential applications here in South Africa. This talk basically is going to be divided into two parts, the first part on flood and the second on hail. And each of those I'm going to start by sort of going through a case study or an example of something we've done in the U.S. and then not going through a full case study for South Africa, but just sort of hinting at how it could be used here. So first, a little bit of background on flood in the United States. In the U.S., flood is primarily done through a government program called the National Flood Insurance Program, which was developed in the late 60s due to a crisis in the market where flood insurance was unavailable. Historically in the U.S., flood has been largely considered to be an uninsurable peril and has not been offered privately, although there have been some exceptions to that for particular niche markets. The NFIP offers flood insurance using flood zones. This is not a very granular method. Primarily, it's based off of estimated frequency. So that's either you're either in a high-risk zone of where there's a 1% annual chance of flood, or you're not in that zone. There is a little bit of additional refinement, but that's basically how it works. This is not an approach that's really, I think, suitable for a private market, although in other countries such as Germany, where they have the Zür zones, there are four Zür zones in Germany where they also have a private flood market, is also not very granular. But this is now changing in the U.S. There's a lot of interest in developing private flood, even though everyone has had it drummed into them for decades that flood is uninsurable. Now everybody doesn't think that anymore, and I've talked to many companies that either are in the process of developing flood or private flood programs, or are interested in developing private flood programs. This is being talked about a lot, and I think within the next several years, the whole market's going to change in the U.S. And so, since we're going from a system where it's really a government-run program that is spectacularly unprofitable with tens of billions of dollars of debt to a private program where we certainly hope that's not going to happen, we need to develop a better method. And that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So what's changed? Why can we now do private flood insurance in the U.S. when we for so many years thought this was impossible? And what really has changed is the computational power has increased to the point where there are catastrophe models that can, with some accuracy, estimate what the expected losses are at a very granular level, down to a resolution of as small as 10 meters. Catastrophe model is a computer model that estimates expected losses. I've done pricing work using other catastrophe models, starting with hurricane and severe thunderstorm and earthquake, and now moving on to flood. So one of the key questions for any area when you're doing this is which perils are there models available for? You can't price flood just off of historical experience because there is insufficient experience at any given location. And since I'm in South Africa, I wanted to mention what perils I've at least been able to find that are available here. There may be others that I'm not aware of, but JBA, based out of the UK, has a flood hazard maps for South Africa, as does Intermap, based in Colorado. Equicat, based in Oakland, California, has a straight line wind model. I have not found a hail model. There may be one that I don't know of, but there are some methods that can be used in the absence of CAT models for hail. That wouldn't work for flood. So just briefly here, I have to talk about geocoding. I'm not sure how widely adopted that is here. It's essentially universal in the CAT-prone areas of the U.S. Geocoders return a latitude-longitude based on an address, and for any pricing exercise where you need a great deal of precision, geocoder is extremely important, and their quality is continually increasing. For the flood peril is pretty much the most granular peril that exists. Hurricanes pretty in the U.S. is pretty granular, flood far more so. So you really, in order to be able to price flood, in my opinion, you need to be able to geocode addresses, figure out exactly what their latitude and longitude is, and you need to at least have a street-level match. The way a geocoder works is, first, it takes an address. People can be amazingly creative in terms of how they give an address for a location. If you've ever done data QC on this, it's really amazing. So what the geocoder first does is it normalizes the address. So you could for example, say Main Street, spell out street. You could do ST. You could do ST period. There are lots of different ways. So the geocoder normalizes it so that it's standard. Then it returns a latitude and longitude for that location. And that latitude and longitude can be a varying levels of data quality. The best would be a point level match or a rooftop match, where you have the exact location of the building. Somewhat, you know, worse than that, but still fairly good, would be a street level match. That's typically done via interpolation. So, for example, if the geocoder knows the latitude and longitude of 100 Main Street and 200 Main Street, if you're at 150 Main Street, then it estimates it as you being halfway between those two locations. So that's not quite as good, but for many purposes may be adequate. If it can't get back at what I would describe as a good match, then it falls back to a postal code level match. That's typically available. That could be a result of somebody having an address and typing it in a way that it can't be normalized. Or very often, if there's a new housing development that it may not yet be in the geocoder and could be added later, that would give you a postal code level match. For some purposes, that may be fine. For flood, I don't think it would be. And the reason for that is that you would there's so much variation in risk within a postal code that you would be subject to adverse selection if you priced just using postal codes. So there are three methods that are currently being considered and being used in the United States for pricing flood. I've spoken to different companies that are using each of these three methods. So there's no consensus about what the best way to do this is at this point. The first method is to query the CAT model at quote time. So In this case, what you would do is you take the latitude longitude, you would actually, at quote time, provide it to the CAT model. The CAT model would return to you an average annual loss. You would gross it up for expenses, and you'd produce a rate. In this case, there would be no published rate in a manual, it would just happen in real time. A lot of people are not willing to do this approach. There are regulatory constraints in some cases. It's also not very transparent. It's as black boxy as it comes, where you get back this AAL and you have no explanation as to why that AAL is what it is or why that premium is what it is. But this is an approach that some people are taking. The advantage of the approach is that it is as close to what can come from the CAT model as anything can be. And so if you believe that the CAT model is the most accurate estimate of the expected loss, then that may be the approach you'd want to take. The second approach, which is the one that I've spent the most time developing, is manual rates using GIS lookups. So in this case, there is would be an actual manual with a set of base rates and rating factors that you could publish, that you could give to insurance agents. And it's a transparent method because you'd be able to see exactly why the rate that's produced is the rate. What makes this possible is the geographic information systems lookup, because of the granularity of the flood peril, you could not, again, as I was saying, you could not give a rate by postal code. That would not work, in my view. But what you could do is you could have a rate by postal code with various modifiers that would get you the granularity that you need. I'm going to be talking about this option in a lot more detail here in the next few slides. The third approach, which is one that has been adopted by a number of companies in the U.S., mostly because it's relatively easy and quick, is to use a simplified rating system, but that really isn't accurate enough, and then make up for it on the underwriting side. So, for example, companies have copied the NFIP rates but undercut them by 20%. Since the NFIP rates are inadequate to begin with, undercutting them by 20% makes you even more inadequate. But the way that companies are doing this and hopefully doing so profitably is by putting underwriting rules on the back end, so they're not willing to write any risk. They're only willing to write the ones that they believe are profitable at those rates, because the very non-granular NFIP rates have a great deal of cross-subsidization built in. And so you can cherry pick. So this gets into the second method, the one that I've spent most time working on. And this is going far beyond a flood zone approach like the NFIP or the Zero Zones in Germany. instead of just having a zone where you're in or out of the zone, this gets to essentially continuous rating. So you start off with a base rate based off of something like what in the U.S. is called hydrological units. These are catchments or drainage basins. And then in addition to that, you'd have a bunch of rating factors for things like elevation, relative elevation, distance to river stream, distance to lake. Relative elevation is probably the only one that isn't obvious what it is. Relative elevation is the elevation of where you are minus the average elevation around where you are. So if you're on the top of a hill, you'd have a positive relative elevation. If you're down on the bottom of a gully, you have a negative relative elevation. And this turns out to be one of the most important rating variables, not surprisingly. And so the advantage, a couple of the advantages of this approach is that the different rating variables here have a strong physical logic to them. It makes sense that if you're higher up, that you're going to have lower risk. If you're lower down, you'll have more risk. If you're near a river, you're at greater risk. They make logical sense. They are to some degree model independent because they're physically based. And they're also things that can be easily explained to insureds or insurance agents. And they are things that insureds tend to know. And so if you're concerned about adverse selection and that the insured maybe knows they're at the top of a hill or worse, at the bottom of a hill, they know they're high risk and they're more likely to buy the insurance, well, you're pricing for that, and so you're less likely to be adversely selected against. So the question then is, how do you set all of those rating factors, those rates and rating factors? And you start with output from a flood CAT model. In the U.S., it's a little more complicated because we have several kinds of flooding. There's basically three. There's a storm surge that's typically generated by hurricanes. There's fluvial flooding, which is rivers, and there's pluvial flooding, which is heavy rain, where the rain pools and doesn't run off quickly enough. The storm surge is probably the most important in terms of dollar loss in the U.S., but not in terms of the area affected because it's only areas right on the coast that tend to be hit by hurricanes. In South Africa, the fluvial and pluvial flooding would be important, but not the storm surge. So I picked an example here to run through where there wouldn't be any storm surge, it's just pluvial and fluvial flooding, so that it'd be more relevant to you. So in terms of the CAP models that we use in the US, there are storm surge models produced by the major vendors like RMS, AIR, Equicat, and again, I'm not going to talk about that today. There are also, and this is what's just recently come online, there are models for fluvial and pluvial flooding. One of the main vendors there is a company called CatRisk, based out of Berkeley, California. AIR, based out of Boston, has recently developed model for non-storm surge flooding as well, and RMS is in the process of developing one. It's an area of active work for pretty much all of the CAP modelers. Once you have an average annual loss from a CAP model, wherever you get it from, then the question is how do you set your rates and rating factors, and the approach that I took is to use a generalized linear model. In this case, I did this for the state of Florida, and I used 5 million locations corresponding to every single family parcel in the state of Florida. I'm only going to show the results for Okeechobee County, and that's because if I showed it for the entire state, you wouldn't be able to see what was going on. It's, again, very granular, and so we need to zoom down to a level where you can see what's happening. Okeechobee County has some of the highest flood risk in Florida, and that's why I picked it. There are various factors other than location is definitely pretty much the most important thing for flood, but there are other things that matter, too. Number of stories, how elevation of the first floor, in many cases in highly flood-prone areas, people have elevated their houses above ground level, and that makes a huge difference in terms of flood risk. Foundation type, is it on stilts, does it have a basement, that sort of thing. Deductible, and as well as contents coverage and loss of use coverage. There are a couple of different ways you can price these different rating factors. This isn't going to be the focus of what I'm talking about, but there's a couple different ways you can do it. For something like number of stories, one approach would be to actually do the analysis separately for one-story and two-story houses. The other way you can do it is you can just put these in as predictors in your GLM and use that to create rating factors. So this is Okeechobee County. It's just north of Lake Okeechobee in southern Florida. And I'm showing here the National Flood Insurance Program flood zones. This is the government flood zones that are currently in use. I said there are just a couple of different zones. That is true in terms of the way things are being priced. X and X500 are treated the same for pricing purposes. A and AE are the ones that have at least a 1% chance of flooding per year. The AE ones are ones where they have created something called base flood elevations, or BFEs. That's the elevation at which you would expect a 1% chance of flood. So the pricing does take into account elevation to a certain degree. Outside of that area, they don't take it into account at all. And you can see that in the map, the areas that are red are the AE areas. And it's a relatively small portion of the county. the orange areas are the A areas. They have at least a 1% chance of flooding, but elevation is not considered in pricing in any of those areas. And the remaining area, the sort of, I don't know what it looks like on the screen for you, but it looks kind of grayish to me. That's an area that has less than a 1% chance of flooding. Elevation is not considered. There is a flat rate. So this isn't a great rating plan. It's going to very likely lead to adverse selection. And so this is why we need to develop something different. This map shows notional locations based on parcel data. So we again have the parcels for every single family house in the state of Florida, and we've put a notional location at the centroid of each parcel, run it through a CAP model, and got back an average annual loss for each location. These are color-coded here. So you can see that the locations are not uniformly distributed. They're clustered, which is typical in terms of where people choose to build their houses. And there's a lot of variation in what the expected loss is. Some areas are very high, some areas much lower. What we want to develop is a way to be able to price any location. This map shows hydrological units, or what are called sub-watersheds. These are drainage basins where all the area water flows from a single point. This is what's called HUC-12s in the U.S. And basically, you would expect that they would have similarity because the water is flowing within that area. So it's a natural way, unlike, say, postal codes, to group areas together. And so this would be a basis for establishing base rates. You could have a different base rate for each hydrological unit. And so I've when I did this analysis, I took the AAL for each of these locations, and I used as my predictor variables hydrological unit and elevation, relative elevation, all these different things that we've been talking about, and that produces an AAL that's then grossed up for expenses, and then that gives me a base rate. And so you can see here what the base rate would be by hydrological unit. The area immediately adjacent to Lake Okeechobee is relatively high risk. Other areas are lower risk. Keep in mind that because this is being done with a GLM, this is after adjustment for distance to river, distance to lake, elevation, relative elevation. So that this is not the final premium or the final rate. This is after you adjust for those things. So yeah. This map shows regular elevation, elevation relative to mean sea level. Not surprisingly, the lower areas are the areas bordering the lake. And Florida is quite flat, so none of the elevation differences here are all that big. But the area in the northern part of the county is about up to 40 meters above sea level, while the area on the lake is at sea level. Hopefully you can see the graph that shows the relative average annual loss. So this is the rating factor that came out of the analysis, and you can see that if you're at very low elevation, going up a bit helps a lot, and then as you get higher up, going up more helps less and less, which makes intuitive sense, I think. And so then this map shows what would be the the rating factor for Okeechobee County. So if we just sort of compare these two maps, this is the actual elevation, and then that's the rating factor. And so the difference between these is here there's a lot of, for Florida at least, a lot of variation in elevation. Here what's going on is the relativity varies a lot in the area right along the lake, and then as you go farther from the lake, it doesn't really matter that much where you are. Even though the elevation is varying quite a bit, the relativity isn't, because the relativity curve flattens out for higher elevations. Then this map shows relative elevation. So this is a layer that we built. We started with an elevation layer, and then we constructed the relative elevation layer by taking the average elevation in a small circle around each location and subtracting the average elevation over a larger circle. And so this really gets at, like, are you on the top of a hill or are you down in a gully? Even if you're 40 meters up, if everything around you is 60 meters up, it's still not a good location to be in. And you can see in the graph here, this really makes a huge, huge difference, especially if you're at negative relative elevation. Going to positive relative elevation, where you're higher than average, is good, but it doesn't make that much of a difference. If you go to negative relative elevation, it makes a huge difference. If you get down to negative 20 meters, which is a very unusual situation, that doesn't happen very often at all, then your risk increases by a factor of 18. Because if it rains, you're going to get some flooding. in the color coding here, you can see the yellow is area that's within half a meter of being at average elevation. So that's basically sort of the neutral relative elevation. And then the green is the hills, and the red tends to be along the rivers. That's areas that are lower down. And so then this map shows what does that translate to in terms of relativities. So the areas that are low-lying are red here, and they have their rate would be increased by a factor of 2 to 4. And then the areas that are green would get decreases. This one may be a little hard to see the map, but basically Florida is filled with lots of little lakes, thousands and thousands of little lakes. So in this map, almost everywhere is green, meaning it's not that close to a lake, but there are hundreds or thousands of like very small lakes that you could potentially be near. Being right on a lake is bad from a flood point of view, but being just a little bit away from it makes a big difference. So if you're 20 meters away, you're probably fine. But if you're very close, then it's a problem because the graph here you see drops off very quickly. This map shows distance to river and the relative loss there. It drops off much more slowly than the distance to lake because of the fluvial flooding. When you get a strong rain event, the flow increases in the rivers and they overflow their banks, and that's a much bigger effect than with the lakes. So it's again on the map, it's a little hard to see because at this scale, being even 100 meters from the river, you're pretty much okay. But if you're within that small distance, then it does make a difference. And although it's again hard to see on the map, it'd be very important for in actual pricing because people know if they're on a river, and if you aren't pricing for that, then they're going to take advantage of it. So this map combines all of the previous maps I just showed you. It takes the base rate by hydrological unit, multiplies it by the factors for elevation, for relative elevation, for distance to river, distance to lake, and comes up with an overall average annual loss. And for most of the areas, it's relatively low, but there are some areas that are higher. Using this approach, you can then price any location in the county, regardless of whether or not you had a notional location there when you ran it through the CAT model. And again, this is something that you could put in a manual. You could have a list of hydrological units where you could say this is the base rate, these are the factors. In practice, you would have to do a GIS lookup through a computer system in order to be able to determine for this particular address what is the elevation, what is the relative elevation, what is the distance to river. But it would be something that would be very transparent. You could explain to the insured, to the insurance agent, the reason I want to give this person a higher price is because they're 10 meters from a river and their relative elevation is negative 5 meters, or whatever it is. So then some validation. I did this using a training holdout approach. And so these next few slides are univariate comparisons of the estimated AAL using the model versus the actual AAL on the holdout sample. So this first one is distance to lake. Again, as we saw, it is bad to be near a lake, but the risk drops very, very quickly, and the estimate and the actual are relatively close to each other. This is the similar graph for distance to river. Being right on a river is even worse than being right on a lake. This is elevation versus sea level. And again, they follow each other relatively closely. This is relative elevation. It does diverge a little bit at the lower relative elevations, but that's an area where there is relatively few locations. The large majority of locations are within a meter, plus or minus a meter of zero. So by the time you get down to these lower ones, you have a lot fewer locations, and so you expect that they're not going to line up totally perfectly. And this is a lift curve. So I have taken on the holdout sample, I've taken the predicted AAL and rank ordered it and broke it into deciles and then looked at what's the actual versus the estimated to see how well this is managing to distinguish the risk, and I think it does a quite good job. The lift is looks like about 14 to 1, so it's successfully identifying the high risk areas and the low risk areas. So that's the end of the first section discussing the Florida example, and now I just want to sort of whet your appetite here with a South African example. This is shows the quaternary drainage regions. This data is freely available. And this would be equivalent to the hydrological units that I was using in Florida. So you could set base rates for each of these quaternary drainage regions. And then I'm going to go through some examples for three different locations in South Africa. This isn't going to be a full analysis where we get rating factors. It's just going to sort of show you how you would set it up. So this is Cape Town. Each of the three examples here are areas where there's a river, and so there's danger of fluvial flooding as well as the pluvial. So this is Cape Town with and the river, and I have the 1,500-year flood depth as produced by JBA. They also have flood depths at other return periods, but this is sort of the most extreme one. So the way this would then work is you wouldn't do this analysis with the, and this is why I haven't completed it. This is one return period. In order to complete the analysis, you need average annual loss by location, not just return period. So to do that, you take the they have multiple flood hazard maps, and if they then linked those together and provided an average annual loss, then you could feed that in to this analysis. But I think this should give you a good idea of how it works. Here I've determined distance to river in Cape Town. One thing is, if you remember from the Florida example, really everything interesting is going on within 100 meters of the river. So here I'm showing distance to river is much greater than that, but really the only area that matters is like the area that's red. Just if I did the colors that way, though, you wouldn't be able to actually see anything on this map. Elevation is very important, as we've seen. For South Africa, you can get elevation from the Shuttle Radar Topography Mission, SRTM, at 30-meter resolution. That's freely available, downloadable. It's a very large file, but you can get that. Intermap has, my understanding is that they do have a 10-meter resolution DEM, so you can get something that's a higher resolution, but that does cost money. This is the SRTM elevation. On the right. I created a relative elevation map based off of the SRTM elevation data for Cape Town. And so you can see the areas that are elevated versus the ones that would be more likely to get the pluvial flooding. Then the next couple, and I know we're running a little late here, so I'm going to just zoom through these. It's the same thing for just two other areas. This is Durban and Port Elizabeth. So Durban, again, 1,500-year flood depth, distance to rivers, elevation, relative elevation. Again, you can see that the low relative elevation tends to be not like exactly at the river, but somewhat near the river. And then you've got some higher areas that have relative elevations over 10 meters, which would be very low risk. Port Elizabeth, again, flood depths, distance to river, elevation, relative elevation. So again, you could set these up as rating factors and develop a flood plan. So that's what I had to say about flood. The next portion of my talk, I'm going to talk about pricing severe thunderstorm. That's an important peril in the U.S. There are basically three sub-perils. There's tornado, hail, and straight line wind. The most important one, it depends on where you are, but is generally hail. And I think that's also the case here, that hail is the most important peril. And so I think there's some relevance. So I'm going to go through what in a couple of examples I did in the U.S. And how that could be used here. Hail is very different from flood. It's not very granular. In the case of flood, you have to use GIS. You have to get down to what's the elevation of this specific point. The risk could be completely different 20 meters away. That's generally not the case with hail. You can use pretty large territories, and that's fine. It's just important that those territories follow what the actual risk is. So one of the implications of that is it means you don't necessarily need to use GIS. For flood, you do. Severe thunderstorm, you could use postal codes. That would probably be a reasonable approach, at least in the U.S., where the hail risk is mostly in areas that tend to be very flat anyway. I think it might be slightly different here. So what I started with here was the average number of hail days per year as estimated by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They took observations and used a kernel smoothing technique to create this map. And then I use that as our starting point. You can see that there's this huge bullseye right in the center of Oklahoma, and then the risk decreases as you go farther out, but it has sort of different shapes in different areas. So one thing that people had been doing to price risk was using things like counties, which tend to not have really the right shape. This, although you can use large territories, it's important that they follow the contours of the risk. So the first thing I did, I start with this map, and then we digitized it and interpolated. Back on this map, this is just showing the number of hail days in integral amounts from 0 through 10 hail days per year. But you may not necessarily want your territory boundaries to be at the points that they have on this map. So we digitized it and interpolated, and so for any location in the United States, we have an estimate of what the number of hail days per year is. And the purpose here is we don't care about hail days per se. What we care about is grouping things that are similar together. So this enables us to group things that are similar together and to make the breaks wherever it makes sense. So analysis I'm going to show here is for Oklahoma, which is, again, where the bullseye is. So this is a territory set that we developed for Oklahoma, and it has the shape that you saw on the previous map. It looks like a bullseye. This is very different than the way people are typically constructing territories based off of counties, which are usually rectangular. And you get something that looks very different, and so you're not grouping things that are alike together. Here you get these sort of weird-looking territories that are sort of annuluses or annuli, where you're grouping things that may not be that close physically to each other, but have similar risk. And some of these territories have relatively narrow width, that's why we had to do the interpolation in order to be able to make them that small. And then there was a validation process where we used cat model data. Everything I've said so far, wasn't using any cat model data. Then you can calculate what's the average severe thunderstorm loss in each of these territories, and what you would expect to see is that it should be monotonic. If it's not, then you've been too aggressive in building your territories. So this is just a little bit of a different example, the same idea. If we go back here, the color scheme is different, but this makes it look like everything that's going on is really in the Great Plains, which is the area of highest risk. But it makes you think, oh, well, you don't care about this if you're anywhere else. That's not really true. People care about hail a lot in the Midwest. And in this map, which shows six states in the Midwestern U.S., this different color ramp, you can see there is a lot of variation, actually, between western Iowa, that's at highest risk, and northern Michigan's lowest risk. Basically, in the U.S., the risk varies southwest to northeast. As in the southwest has the higher risk. As you go to the northeast, it goes down. So one thing you could do, based on what I've been saying in my talk so far, you might think, well, what I want to do is I want to choose different hail day frequencies and make territories based on different breaks. And you could do that. That would make perfect sense. But companies may not want to implement a GIS approach for something like hail, where you don't really need to and it's a lot of programming. They might prefer to just use postal codes. And since, as I was saying, hail is not very granular, so that's a reasonable thing to do. So the next few slides, I'm going to show how you can do this with just postal codes instead of GIS. So the first thing, if you have CAT model data from a severe thunderstorm model for an actual portfolio, and you do a GLM approach similar to what I described for flood, you'll back into factors by postal code. And you can see here that it looks very similar to what I showed from the NOAA data. So I'll just go back. So this is from NOAA data, interpolated hail days. Whoops. And then this is from a CAT model. And they show the same pattern, which they should. If this is describing what's going on, they should be similar. Now, you can't really set your territorial relativities or even create your territories directly from this, because you can see there are lots of gaps. If it's a real portfolio, there are going to be lots of places where there aren't any policies. So what you can do then is interpolate to fill in the postal codes that are missing. And now you can really see, once you've interpolated to fill in the missing postal codes, looks very, very similar. This is from two different data sources, very similar. You will notice, if you're looking carefully, there are some anomalies, like in the western part of Iowa on the far left, there's a little green spot amidst an area of red. That's because this is, if you take something with real data, you might have one location, and that location is different than, and is creating an anomaly. So you don't want to replicate that when you get to actually building your territories. The next step on this would be doing a clustering algorithm to create territories where you're minimizing the within variance and maximizing the between variance. maybe I've been going a little too far here. I promise we're almost done. This is the hail territories that you would then get from that approach. And these are rating factors for each of those territories. So you've now have developed territories for hail that you could price just using postal codes. And then this is, I think, my last slide is non-geographic rating factors. In addition, I mean, geography is important, but there are other things that matter. Construction type, year of construction, number of stories. Number of stories is an important one, because if hail damages the roof, if you have a some multi-story structure for a given amount of value, it has a smaller percentage of roof area, and therefore it's lower risk. And you can price the other coverages in that way. One last slide. This is my slide for South Africa. There is a company. In order to do this in South Africa, you would need a number of hail days. You can get that from companies like Weather Analytics, and then determine the implied risk, similar to what I did in the Midwest, and then group those areas to form territories. There's an interesting paper by LaRue and Olivier from about 20 years ago that argues that in South Africa, elevation has an impact on hail risk as well as the region. And so in South Africa, you might need to, in addition to constructing these territories, also use an elevation factor. It would be possible to determine that using data from Weather Analytics or possibly company data if you have enough of a volume. And then from that, you could then create your territories and then set the relativities in the absence of CAT model data, set the relativities based on your historical losses. So now we can take a break. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Hi, it's Martinez from OutSurance. I'm just curious, with rate filing being quite common in the States, do you find that flood rating converge a bit? Because it's normally, once you bring in more differentiation, the rates tend to spread out.
So this is, this is very recent developments in the U.S. People have only started working on this within the last year or so. In most cases, for flood, the more complicated things haven't been filed yet. They're still being developed. I think that once they get filed and approved, I didn't really discuss the changes in the regulatory environment, but the regulatory environment is changing, and there's a lot of encouragement to write private flood. For example, in the state of Florida, which is probably one of the more important ones, you don't have to get rates approved for the next 4 years, I think it is. You have to file them, but it doesn't require approval. So that gives people a lot of flexibility. Over time, I think that this will, this is going to result in cherry picking. The NFIP is going to end up with the worst risks, and there's going to be a lot of a big move towards a lot of rate differentiation. It's going to have to be.
Thanks.
Thanks, Matt. That was excellent, I think. A simple question. Just the relative elevation was fascinating to see. What kind of difference do you see the two circles? So the larger one was at 3 kilometers by 500 meters, or what did you find gave you a relatively good match when you tried to determine the relative elevation?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we looked at the way we did it was we looked at a bunch of different possibilities for the two different circles and determined which one gave us the best match. Eventually, I think it was 100 meters for the first circle and 2 kilometers, I think it was, for the second.
Thanks.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.